Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Susan Thompson. This is my first interview for the New Books Network in African Studies. I'm delighted to welcome my very first guest, Reinhard Kessler. He's a professor of politics at the University of Freiburg in Germany. He's written a fascinating book on German reparations, or the lack therein, in Namibia, titled Nambia and Germany, Negotiating the Past, published in 2015 by the University of Namibia Press. Of course, many of you may know that today's Namibia was once at the German colony of Southwest Africa for a 30-year period beginning in 1884, ending in 1915. From 1904 to 1908, German colonial troops committed the first genocide of the 20th century against the Herero and Nama peoples, many of whom rebelled against the labor and land impositions of colonial rule. Victims of the genocide have yet to receive justice, for the German colonial authority and indeed the German government today consider the violence of that period to be a byproduct of its policy of settler colonization. Enter the work of Reinhard Kessler. His book, of course, argues that the German government needs to address its legacy of settler colonial rule and that ordinary German citizens also have an obligation and a right to know their country's violent past. Kessler's book advocates a way forward for dialogue and debate on Germany's Namibian past, linking it, of course, to the Holocaust and different events inside Namibia. Reinhard Kessler, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you.
I'm excited to have you. I wanted to start with an overview for those who may not know the German case. What is Germany's colonial legacy in today's Namibia, then German Southwest Africa? What happened and to whom and why?
Germany started its colonial quest in 1884, and Namibia, also a very arid region, was the only of the German colonial acquisitions which was considered as a viable settler colony. So that sets it apart from other German colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And the dynamics of settler colonialism always mean that indigenous people are driven off the land. They are either really killed off or they are reduced to the status of chattel labor force.
Mm-hmm.
So the genocide of 1904-1908 was in some ways in the logic of this settler colonial project. Also, of course, there was controversy. There were also people saying, oh, we are really destroying the foundations on which to build the colony because people are being killed, cattle is lost, and so forth. But in basically, it is in the potential and logic of settler colonialism, what happened. Now, I think to not to be too long, this genocide was, in my view, particular among the genocides of the 20th century, since it was actually happening in open public view. There was actually a lot of publicity of the war and the genocide and the crimes, what would today be crimes against humanity, quite clearly in the German press, in postcards showing hanging scenes and even worse and so forth. Crimes were extolled as heroic deeds of the German army, which was going on, I think, more or less right up to 1945. And so it is, of course, not the same as the Nazi crimes, but it is linked to the Nazi crimes. There's little doubt, I think. And at the same time, by the post-war, post-World War II period, this whole complex was out of the public mind. It sort of was overshadowed by the Holocaust. It was also, of course, overshadowed by the economic miracle in Western Germany. And so what has happened actually since about 2004, the centenary of the Battle of the Waterberg, Oha Makari, which is sort of the beginning of the genocide, has been a slow awakening of at least sections of the German public. In the media, on the other side, this has always been for Overero and Mama, this has always been life history. It has been handed down by oral traditions and reproduced in annual commemorations. So we have a very, very different situation there, and it's quite obvious that people were not able, up to 1990, Namibian independence, really to campaign for what they see as their rights, reparations, and apology from Germany. And so that has been getting underway since then, and also, I would say, in more intense ways for the last 20 or 15 years.
So tell me this, so what you're saying then is that the past is definitely not agreed upon. There's an official sort of silencing on the German side. You have this legacy of late independence, so Namibia becoming what is today Namibia only in 1990. How is this past being mediated between the official version, the German version, let's say, the Namibian government, and those descendants of survivors of the genocide of 1904 to 1908?
Well, I think the starting point to sketch this out would be the resolution of the Bundestag, the German parliament, in 1989, when Namibian independence was impending. And there the Bundestag stated there is a special responsibility of Germany towards Namibia, but the resolution does not tell you why there is a special responsibility. That is partly because the parties at that time could not agree on the reason. So there was the presence of a German-speaking minority, there was actually the colonial path, and there was the collaboration of the West German government with the apartheid regime and the illegal occupation of Namibia by South Africa during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So that was apparently a reason why they did some lock rolling, and in the end, they said, okay, we agree on the smallest denominator, which means just state special responsibility. And by that very token, they don't address the genocide explicitly at all. Now, the Namibian government has been very, very quiet for a long time about the issue, possibly because there is very substantial German overseas development assistance. Actually, Namibia is getting the highest per capita ODA from Germany worldwide, but of course per capita, not in actual sums, because Namibia is a very small country population-wise. Now, when there started to be a serious mobilization in sections of the affected communities, and people started to organize and really make their voices heard, this also prompted the Namibian government slowly to also join into this campaign in a specific way, and that is still very controversial as we speak, because the Namibian government now claims that they alone can represent Namibians, their citizens, whereas the affected communities, many parts of the affected communities, to be more precise, insist that they must have their own independent representation at the negotiating table. And so this is a deadlock that still persists. I should mention, I haven't mentioned yet, sorry for the omission, that there has been a formal negotiation between the two governments since 2015, when the German Foreign Office, by its spokesperson, let it be known that now they would accede to the term of genocide, which they had formally not done. It was sort of a taboo to talk about genocide in German official language. They then acceded to that, and this sort of was part of the opening for these formal negotiations. But it seems we don't know too much about them, since they are behind closed doors, but it seems they are still in a deadlock on these two basic counts. The one is how do you involve the affected communities? The other is the issue of reparations, because German diplomacy is adamant that there will be no reparations. There will be some form of payment, yes, but they are adamant not to call it reparation, apparently because they are afraid of setting a precedent for compensating German crimes during the Second World War.
No, I mean, you raise a lot of interesting points in your comments there. I want to unpack some of them. So you made, I think, what is a really important point, that only in 2015, you know, 100 years after the end of formal German rule, did the government of Germany begin to think, well, we should apologize, we should atone. And as you noted, they acknowledged that the policy of massacres and starvation and forced deportations and concentration camps and so on as a form of genocidal violence. They used the word genocide, but then they also denied their legal culpability or responsibility for the crime. So this, for me, raises two questions. You write in your book in one chapter about the 2001 alien tort case. And as we both know, your book came out in 2015, but later in 2017, descendants and representatives of the traditional authorities from the Herero and Namo communities launched a second alien tort case. Maybe there's a third, I don't know, but they did cite very clearly they are seeking reparations, their language is reparations, for the incalculable damages, you know, in quotes, that German colonial rule has wrought, acknowledging the policy of genocide. And of course, their case was denied, as we both know, in March 2019. So what can happen from an apology that doesn't lead to reparations? How can traditional communities, traditional authorities begin to negotiate with American courts and the alien tort system, representatives of the Namibian government who are trying to safeguard their, you know, ODA from Germany, and of course the German government, who is open, but open only on its own terms, if I'm understanding you correctly?
Yeah, I think it's a quandary in a way. I think I'm afraid to say that German official stance is really responsible for that. I think they are mainly safeguarding a judicial legal position, because of that, they are not really moving, and they are actually invoking colonial legal instruments, like claiming that the legal provisions that prevailed even at the time among civilized powers, in inverted commas, were not applicable to the war in Namibia. Actually, there is a quote from the diary of the commanding general, Lothar von Trotha, who exactly says, no, it's not on to wage war in Africa under the Geneva Convention. So this general was aware that he was in contravention to the existing laws, but the German Foreign Office, through its lawyers, still maintains, no, these laws were not applicable to colonize people, in inverted commas, to natives. Mm-hmm. So it is a very, very serious thing what we are watching, apart from the merits of the legal merits of the cause, which is now still in its second round in the U.S. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how it will turn out. But these statements in the name of the German Foreign Office are a disgrace as they stand.
So you've really directed your analysis in many ways at Germany and German citizens. How is the acknowledgement, at least from the German Foreign Office and other representatives of the German government, that their colonial policy was genocidal? How is that shaping debate in Germany at all? One thing that really struck me in your book is that ordinary Germans don't know, and they don't know because, of course, the talk of colonial crimes, colonial rule, settler colonization, and so on was really suppressed after World War II for reasons, you know, we can all guess, the end of World War II and so on. What's happening in Germany right now amongst ordinary people, but also amongst the government? I know you yourself have participated in protests in Berlin and elsewhere with members of the Herero community.
Well, this is still in the German public. It is a very minoritarian issue, and it most likely will never be anything else than a minoritarian issue. There are various reasons. People still are not very much aware that Germany ever was a colonial power. And what I call a colonial amnesia, of course, also pertains not only to not knowing, but certainly not caring. And Germans can afford not to care. Yeah. So this is a very, very uphill struggle to begin with. But one must say that in the last few years, there has been some progress. So there have been reports in the quality media on various instances of returning human remains from scholarly institutions in Germany, most lately also the return of the Bible and the writing of the Namibian national hero Hendrik Witbooi in last February. And this also drew quite a bit of attention, and it was in the media. And so things are happening where, as you probably know, there is a debate going on about holdings of colonial holdings of museums. It's all over Europe, and I believe also one can say in the US and Australia, certainly as well, various other regions. And that has drawn a lot of attention. So the federal government in Germany has proclaimed last year, when they got into office, that they would make the issue of colonial holdings of museums sort of the a major theme of their of their work during this period, parliamentary period. The same, the minister said the same as it has been the last for the last period, the art that has been robbed by the Nazis from Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Those were grand words, and one wonders what is going to happen. At least there are tentative moves, and the main problem at the moment is that, of course, you must at least know what museums hold, where the holdings come from, how they got into the museum, and this is such a blank space in our knowledge for the most part that I don't think we will see in any solution in our lifetimes. So it turned out that the museums are understaffed. They're not. They are in very, very many cases, they're in very bad shape. So any idea that this will be resolved in a foreseeable time is, I think, an illusion. So it is much, but there's much talk and rather little action. But at least we have some publicity. There is also, as you may or may not know, in Germany it's important, the plan to have this grand museum of African, Asian, and Oceanic, Latin, South American art, mm-hmm. in the center of Berlin, in the reconstructed castle of the Hohenzollerns, which is in itself a big, big problem in what they have conceived. But of course, the controversy over that is also sort of drawing attention to these issues. And the initiative of President Macron of France to say, okay, we go give back holdings of museums and so forth. So there is something going on that side, but it is not really as far as satisfying any of the concerns of the Namibians, I'm afraid.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it also seems to preclude any conversation about reparations. So since the German government does not want to use the language of reparation, because of course they give ODA in great numbers by their own measure, you noted, of course, per capita, it's actually not that impressive a number. But your comment has me thinking as I listen to you, you wrote a really profound, richly empirical, what I would consider a piece of public scholarship, because you say in the intro quite clearly, I'm not going to bog you down with theory. I'm going to use the concepts as they come up and explain them as they relate to my overall argument about colonial crimes and, of course, the politics of memory and the different conceptual realms of memory. What kind of scholarship do you see happening in Namibia? Obviously scholars like you, but is there a second generation in Germany, another generation, or an up-and-coming set of junior scholars, PhD students who are thinking about these questions? Or are we at a critical juncture where the past may not be negotiated because simply too much time will pass and those with the energy and passion to take on the work will no longer be with us?
Well, of course, that is always an issue, the so-called moving gap in terms of our history. But I'm rather optimistic as far as the upcoming or already more or less established generation of younger scholars is concerned. I think there is a real cohort of Namibian historians and social scientists who have changed the situation dramatically. So they are not all working on issues of the German colonial period, of course. There are a number of practical questions and issues there, like actually very few people being able to read German in that group. But they are active and they are creative, and I think that is the main thing to look for before then turning to the world outside the media, which where I see really also a lot of activity, also in terms of international scholarship. So quite a few people from the US actually doing PhDs which relate to issues of the German period or later in the media and this kind of work. And in Germany, there is also a lot going on in terms of PhD thesis. And unfortunately, for Namibian studies, it's still not a general rule that people publish in English. Some still publish their stuff in German, which is a pity, because then Namibians are left out, except the German speakers, and that's an effect which is highly unwelcome in my view.
It sounds like, though, what you're describing is a moment of optimism and perhaps even an openness on the part of Namibians themselves, but perhaps also the Namibian government to allow these types of studies to go forward. Because we also know, just thinking about African studies more broadly, some countries are not very welcoming of foreign researchers. And I mean, rightfully so, that's their sovereign right to say so. But it does sound like Namibia enjoys a certain openness. Is that fair to say, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think it is really remarkable that people in Namibia holding posts at the University of Namibia can publish very critical stuff. Where I was really thinking, oh wow, this person is really a courageous woman or man who really does not put their professional interests first, but really they speak their minds.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, government does allow it. Basically, they must be aware of it. And they did have a few years ago. They did have a very terrible regulations about research, not only for foreigners, for everybody. A very bureaucratic sort of stifling idea, but it was fended off. And also, one might say many critical things about Namibian politics and about the workings of the Namibian state and so forth and so forth. One must say they allow considerable leeway both for local people and for people who come and do research. That is really true.
Is there any sort of public protest or, I don't know, parades or commemorations that are monitored, or people, you speak in your book about different celebrations and different traditions that the Herero and Nama traditional authorities engage in. And of course, when you're in Namibia, you can see traces of this. They meet particular times of the year and so on. Is this informed by scholarship, or is there a gap between civil society and scholarship, or do you see them sort of a public scholarship or more of an activist scholarship? I felt your book fell into sort of an activist call insofar as you wanted Germans to do a particular thing with Namibians. How are the Namibians perceiving? Do they think about Germany? Is Germany a constant thing, or are they more in negotiation with the current government, the SWAPO government?
No, I think, one has to be specific about who speaks in Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
Concerns about the German period are certainly much more intense in the center and the south of the country, the area where German colonialism was effectively enforced, than in the north, where all these things didn't happen. And there was quite a different trajectory. People who engage these issues, they are, of course, very much concerned about Germany, although they don't know too much about Germany. So I always find myself explaining and trying to sometimes also dampen hopes when, again, for instance, the left parliamentary party in the Bundestag files a motion where they say, oh, this is exactly what we want. Now we can move forward. I say, no, mm-hmm. Don't hold your horses.
Yep.
This motion will be thrown out. It's quite clear. It's only that it is on the floor of the parliament, and that's a very good thing, and
right,
as far as we can get at this stage. So That is one thing. The other thing is how far do they really relate to the literature that is produced.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was very important when I published this book consider how can it be made available in Namibia. And this was actually the reason why I decided I'm not looking for some university press in the US or such, but I'm use the University of Namibia Press, which was then sort of in a relaunch phase, luckily, so it was a very, very good situation for doing so, to bring it closer to people. And to some extent, it has also worked, but for other scholarship, it's always difficult. I found that people say, "Oh, there is no research on our issues and over Herero," and I said, "No, of course there is." But then I thought, "Okay, such and such has published in German. Such and such is somehow maybe not available in Namibia." And of course, there's also a certain gap between people's concerns and the way people relate to their own issues and reading up scholarship. That is also clear.
I think it's a really interesting response that you give, because one thing I did admire about your book is, you know, it's a very professionally produced book. You wouldn't know that it wasn't produced by a so-called American, you know, press in inverted quotes. I don't think American presses actually always do a good job publishing on Africa. I've been disappointed of late, for example, from Oxford and Cambridge. They seem just to produce things very quickly, and the scholarship is not rigorous. And one thing I really appreciated was the plates. You have images throughout the book, and they're placed well, and it really brings your text to life. And it did make, you know, I really appreciated your contribution and the volume and level of research, private interviews, archival work, your own observations. It's a real, you know, what Americans would call mixed methods approach. And I think you produced like a very important post-colonial piece of work. Because one thing that we really haven't talked about yet, and I think we should mention for our listeners, is that you mentioned it at the outset, part of what we're dealing with here, and it kind of goes unspoken, is South Africa's long occupation of Southwest Africa. And of course, this feeds into something you talk about in the book quite a bit, the over sort of viable, I guess, presence of white Germans in present day Namibia. So you have these legacies of the apartheid era playing themselves out in this German space with whites who would like to see things stay the way they are. And then, of course, you have Germany sort of dancing around the issue of reparations. From what I understand, it's not going to happen anytime soon, if it happens at all. And, of course, the question becomes, why do white Namibians have such an outside presence in these debates? They seem not to realize their own history in the country in which they live. And then, of course, how can Namibians get closure? Is reconciliation a possibility when memory is so contested, and as you note in your book, silenced in many cases, even as commemorations are happening with local communities?
I think it's a difficult issue. The first, of course, what comes to mind is the German speakers, and I think one has to be aware German speakers are about 15,000 or so at the moment, an overall population of something like 2.2 or 3 million right now. So it's a very tiny minority, and the great majority of whites would be Afrikaans speakers, actually. So, and they have to some extent a different approach. I think the German speakers are a very closed community. They are very privileged. They have the highest, by far the highest standards of living in the country as far as we can tell from statistical data. And so there is a German daily newspaper. There are radio programs, I think even TV. And of course, they also have their German TV and through commercial channels. So these people are really, to some extent, actually also not living in the country to an extent. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they claim, their proponents, I should say, often claim they are the ones who know about the country and its nature, and of course, nature in many ways, including so-called native tribes, what they call.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a very difficult conglomerate, and a very difficult one also in reaching reconciliation, as you say. I have been talking to people not on the side of the German speakers, but on the Nama side and Guerrero side, who said, whom can we turn to? Is it possible to find somebody whom we can talk to among the German speakers? It's very, very difficult. It's really difficult. So not that there are not German speakers who are different, younger people in particular, but they don't, for good measure, they don't identify so much
as
Südwesters. They travel under different logos, and I think understandably so. So it is a really difficult thing. And at the same time, of course, the stance of the Namibian government is also problematic, in my view, mm-hmm. Because they don't really acknowledge the different trajectories. Which also means they don't properly acknowledge the contribution of the forebears of the affected communities to anti-colonial resistance. And so the claims we have really taken the brunt of this violent onslaught. It does not reverberate in official memory politics.
Well, it's so interesting that you finish on that note, because, of course, when you travel around Namibia, you do see German representations of the past quite a bit. Mm. You don't see very much of genocide history reported. So, for example, I visited just in December the Social History Museum in the town of Swakopmund, which, of course, concentration camps were there. And, you know, it's two floors, and there's lots of history, but it's a white German and a white Afrikaans, yeah. as you know. And then there's sort of one panel on the genocide, and you wonder, like, what exactly do they think happened? And you ask the attendant or the curator, I'm not sure who, you ask a white person, like, so what happened in 1904? Oh, that's not for us. That was something that happened. Yeah. So, and you know, you bring this out in your book. Ordinary citizens either don't know or are unprepared to take on the responsibility. And you say very clearly in your conclusion that this lack of knowledge is no excuse for the lack of reparation or the lack of reconciliation. Mm. So, as we begin to wrap up, what advice would you give to Germans, whether in Germany or not, perhaps white people more broadly? How can we begin to meet Namibians, you know, Herero and Nama people in particular, somewhere in the middle on the crimes that were committed in the name of the state of Germany?
I think it needs more openness, more readiness to listen. I think Germans tend to be very much, especially also officialdom on the side of telling Africans what to do. I just had this experience quite recently, but it is really like that, and this does not help much. I think the main issue is the main task would be so to take people's concerns seriously, to listen to them, hear them out, and of course try to be constructive, and that also means not forget about the material side of the issue, which is there must be compensation, and it must be a foregone conclusion. You cannot apologize for a mass crime as a genocide in the same way of when I step on your foot. You know, that is a very different kind of situation. And at the same time, it is quite clear that the official apology is wanting in a very dramatic and scandalous manner. One has to remember that before that statement in 2015 by the Foreign Office, the Parliament started the adoption of a resolution on the genocide against Armenians in 1915. And it was more or less in the wake of that that people said, oh, but there is something on closer to home as well. And so this is not sorted out, and the Foreign Office has come up with the idea that they negotiate about the wording of the apology. And it is also something which one has to ponder about. Where does the side that is on the perpetrator side, of course, perpetrators are no longer with us, direct victims are no longer with us, but there are positions of the perpetrator. You don't negotiate what you say. You know that you have to know what to say.
So yeah, that your comment reminds me of something that I saw in the Waterberg. Actually, there were graves for German troops. Some of them had. There was a visiting book, so you could see who had visited. It looks like some ancestors, some relatives of troops who passed in what was then Southwest Africa, now Namibia, continue to return and to honor their fallen soldiers. And of course, you're looking around for a similar monument or some sort of marker for the lives that were lost on the Nama and Herero side, the Namibian side. And you really can't see one. There's no such thing. Even when you go to the graves in Swakopmund, there is a monument for the atrocities committed against these people. There's no mention of the word genocide, which, of course, incenses some people. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, it's a very, very unfortunate wording on that particular monument. But as you say, German war graves, and indeed to some extent also South African war graves, are scattered all over the southern and central Namibia. You can find them on the actual battlefields. You can find them in church graveyards, local church graveyards, and so forth and so forth. But there are very, very few ways of commemorating the anti-colonial resistance fighters. And where there are, it's most of the time very recent memorials, that is in a few cases that has happened. But the actual, the graves of those who have fought and who have perished in the concentration camps as well, they are for the most time unknown, unmarked, and it's a great shame.
It is a great shame, but it makes me wonder too. Like, I also visited, you touch on this in the book as well, some of the monuments, the SWAPO Nationalist Museum, or the Independence Museum, I guess it's called. And it makes me, so you do see references to the atrocities of the colonial period, but also that museum is really dedicated to the struggle for independence from South Africa in particular, but colonial rule more broadly. And it makes me wonder, this is a question I had reading your book, is it a feature of post-colonial state building to erase painful memories? Do we have to have a founding myth that promotes unity? Is there something in liberation wars, for example, that allows us to put in the past what has happened in the past and ask everyone to move forward?
Yeah, well, I think, of course, unity is a very strong motive in that particular museum and the narrative it conveys. And I think it's also important to understand that quite apart from the artistic merits or demerits of what you see in that museum. But I doubt whether unity has always to be uniformity, representing sort of a undifferentiated picture of anti-colonial resistance of Namibia, but as a territory was only created in the course of colonial rule. So it was not possible for the northern groups really to participate in inter-colonial resistance in the German period. There was one single instance where the king in the Hale of Donga led his troops against the Forna Motoni, which is now a rest camp in the Tosha National Park. Mm-hmm. But that was the one single instance, which of course is now celebrated as a sign of unity. But I think it's much more complex. And at the same time, of course, the projection of the national liberation struggle, which is not really the object of my research, but has to be reflected always along with what I look at. The national liberation struggle is shown as a largely military affair, an affair of diplomacy, or sort of the exile group that led SWAPO and represented SWAPO internationally. Very important, but that obliterates largely what has happened inside the country. Mm-hmm. And people who have fought in women's group churches, labor unions, and so forth. So that whole dimension, or various dimensions, is hardly mentioned. There is a picture of a church or something like that, but there's very little of what happened inside the country in that particular narrative.
I have two more questions before we wrap up. Thank you for everything so far. I wanted to ask you a question, sort of one political scientist to another. What comparative lessons do you see from the Namibian case, the Southwest Africa case, for other cases in Africa or elsewhere? I'm thinking in particular of Rwanda. Of course, their genocide was 25 years ago. We have genocides ongoing, perhaps, depending on your definition, in Darfur, Yemen, events that happened in Peru or Guatemala or Cambodia. Any comparative lessons from your study that others could take away?
I think for the more recent cases, I guess salvaging memories as far as it's possible is very important. Just comes to my mind a occasion which I found very, very moving when I was called to participate in a event in on Long Island at the Holocaust Memorial and Tolerance Center, which was partly co-organized by Overhero living in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it was attended by a large contingent of survivors and descendants of survivors of the Holocaust as well. And there was this one gentleman, obviously in his 80s, well into his 80s, and he had just arrived from Vienna, where he was originally from, and had given talks in schools in Vienna. And then he said, "Oh, I think we have to learn from these Namibians because of their vibrant oral traditions. And when we time witnesses will no longer be there, we must have similar oral traditions that can be preserved over the generations." I found that very, very moving. Also, solidarity between these two groups, Holocaust survivors and descendants of the genocide, but at the same time, the idea we could learn from each other, especially in transmitting the memory. And of course, it also applies to preserving memories.
Yeah, you make an important. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To the measure that people are able and prepared to talk about their experiences, I'm quite aware that this is not always the case, and I think we all can count ourselves lucky that we haven't had to go through this and don't have any position to argue whether somebody has to talk or not. That is really their own decision, and very much respect those who do, and even who open up their transgenerational memory in the Namibian case.
You mean you make an important methodological and ethical point that, you know, salvaging lived memories and separating them from the official narrative is a very delicate business, and we must treat it with the utmost respect. Reinhard, I want to thank you for chatting with me today. I really enjoyed it. And as we begin to wrap up, I want to ask just two final questions. One, is there anything that I haven't asked that you want listeners to know? And second, what are, you know, two or three books, a book that you would recommend to learn more about what we've discussed today?
Oh, now I think we have covered a lot of ground, so I wouldn't want to add more. The two books that come to my mind actually, unfortunately, are in German. So I hope there will be English versions at some point, but I will mention them. It's first the work by Gesine Krüger on the ways Overhero has remembered and engaged with that memory of the genocide, I think more or less through the 1930s.
Oh, thank you.
So it's a very historical one. And the second is by Larissa Förster, who has given this marvelous account of the memory landscape of Waterberg, of various actors, so Overhero and German speakers at the Waterberg. And when you come back to the Waterberg and you can read German, it's your Watermeckum as well.
I can add one in English. I just read it a couple months ago and I really enjoyed it. It's The Kaiser's Holocaust, by Elsocha and Erickson, I think, for English. It, like, it's just a shocking book. And it did, reading that book first and then reading your book second was a very powerful experience for me. So I'll just add that. I hope you don't mind. Thank you. We've been discussing Reinhard Kessler's book, Namibia and Germany, Negotiating the Past, published in 2015 by the University of Namibia Press. Reinhard, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you.